Senate Judiciary Committee is one day closer to concluding confirmation hearings for Judge Amy Coney Barrett, who, if confirmed, will replace the late Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg on the Supreme Court bench. We'll have more on today's testimony and what took place inside the Judiciary Committee's hearing room in just a moment. This is Washington Today for Wednesday, October 14th. I'm your host, John McArdle. First, some other headlines from around the nation's capital. Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin spoke for an hour this morning on a new round of stimulus and coronavirus response spending. The two sides are set to meet up again tomorrow, but they remain far from an agreement. Roll Call reported today that Democrats are pressing the Trump administration for more robust funding for state and local governments and more detailed planning on a COVID-19 testing strategy. For his part, Mnuchin is stressing the need for liability protection from pandemic-related lawsuits for small businesses and schools that reopen. On the campaign trail, President Trump is now set to participate in an NBC News town hall held outdoors in Miami on Thursday. That's the same night Joe Biden will participate in his own town hall event with ABC News in Philadelphia. The events will take place in lieu of the second presidential debate, which was canceled last week after the president objected to new plans for a virtual format. And on the president's health, the White House provided news outlets a statement today about the status of the president's recovery from coronavirus. The statement from NIH's clinical director Clifford Lane said that he and Dr. Anthony Fauci reviewed tests this week and found with a high degree of confidence that the president is no longer shedding infectious virus. The news comes on the same day that a statement from First Lady Melania Trump revealed that 14-year-old Barron Trump has tested positive for coronavirus, but is not experiencing any symptoms. Back to the Senate Judiciary hearing for day three of the Supreme Court confirmation hearings for Amy Coney Barrett. Senators used their 20 and 10-minute rounds of questions to focus on a variety of topics, from matters of constitutional law to the Houston Astros baseball cheating scandal. Under questioning Wednesday from Democratic Senator Patrick Leahy of Vermont, President Donald Trump's choice for the high court chose not to offer her opinion on whether a president would be able to issue a pardon to himself. Here's that exchange.
Now, let me ask you a specific that has come up. President Trump claims he has an absolute right to pardon himself. Now, for 200 years, the Supreme Court has recognized a common law principle that nobody can be a judge in their own case. I had to go way back and reread Calder versus Bull to see that. But would you agree, first, that nobody is above the law? Not the president, not you, not me. Is that correct?
I agree. No one is above the law.
And does a president have an absolute right to pardon himself for a crime? I mean, we heard this question after President Nixon's impeachment.
Senator Leahy, so far as I know, that question has never been litigated. That question has never arisen. That question may or may not arise, but it's one that calls for a legal analysis of what the scope of the pardon power is. So because it would be opining on an open question when I haven't gone through the judicial process to decide it, it's not one on which I can offer a view.
Okay, you were willing to say that no person, not you, not me, not a president, is above the law. I find your answer somewhat incompatible, but those are your answers. You have a right to say what you want.
Senator Patrick Leahy, Democrat of Vermont, with Judge Amy Coney Barrett earlier today. Republican Senator Ted Cruz of Texas focused most of his time on Democratic senators rather than Judge Barrett. His remarks came after a number of Democrats chose to appear at the hearing virtually instead of in person in a nod to coronavirus safety precautions. One of those senators is California Senator and Democratic Vice Presidential nominee Kamala Harris. Here's Senator Ted Cruz, Republican of Texas, and Senator Dick Durbin, Democrat of Illinois.
We've revealed the news that Judge Barrett is going to be confirmed by this committee and by the full Senate. With two full days of questioning, we've seen that our Democratic colleagues have very few questions, actually, to raise about Judge Barrett's qualifications. Very little of the time we've spent in here has concerned her record as a judge, her 20 years as a respected scholar. Instead, much of this hearing has focused on political attacks directed at President Trump. I recognize our Democratic colleagues are not going to be voting for President Trump in November. That's certainly their prerogative. But they've largely abandoned even trying to make the case that Judge Barrett is anything other than exceptionally well qualified to serve as a justice. It is striking that as we sit here right now in this committee room, there are only two Democratic senators in the room. If you look at the dais, there's chair after chair after chair that is empty. The Democratic senators are no longer even attending. I assume they'll show up for their time. But it is indicative of what they're tacitly admitting, which is that they don't have substantive criticisms.
Mr. Chairman, may I make a point of personal privilege?
Of course.
We're in the midst of a COVID-19 crisis, a pandemic, and some members are in their offices following this on television, and to suggest their absence here means they're not following or participating is incorrect.
I would note the senator from Illinois, in his personal privilege, somehow omitted the fact that all but two of the Democrats were physically here yesterday, and after the questioning, they made the decision not to be here. That's fine. You're welcome to make that decision. But it's indicative, when it comes to the time of the questioning, that this side of the aisle does not have arguments against Judge Barrett that have any chance of prevailing.
That was Senator Ted Cruz, Republican of Texas, and Senator Dick Durbin, Democrat of Illinois. Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar, a Democrat, picked up on a line of questioning brought up last night by Senator Kamala Harris over how independent a potential Justice Barrett could be on the high court. Here's that exchange.
Follow up on something that Senator Harris and I asked you about yesterday, and that is the issue of whether or not you understood the president's clear position on the Affordable Care Act before you wrote the article in which you criticized the legal reasoning for upholding the Affordable Care Act. The president tweeted just one day after you were nominated, that would be September 27th, that it would be a big win if the Supreme Court strikes down the health law. But before you were nominated, and this is what we showed yesterday, Donald Trump tweeted promising that his judicial appointments will do the right thing on Obamacare, unlike Justice Roberts. Yesterday, you were asked by Senator Harris, prior to your nomination, were you aware of President Trump's statements committing to nominate judges who will strike down the Affordable Care Act? You said, I can't really definitively give you a yes or no answer. What I would like to say is I don't recall hearing about or seeing such statements. And after she followed up, you said that the tweet wasn't something that I heard or saw directly by reading it myself. Okay, so I just want to go through some of the things that have happened over the last few years regarding the president's really his obsession to repeal Obamacare. He said, we will repeal and replace disastrous Obamacare when accepting the Republican nomination at the Republican convention in 2016. Did you see that speech?
At the Republican convention
in 2016. I'm not asking if you were there. I was asking if you saw it on TV.
No, I don't believe I watched any of the convention on TV. Or
okay.
I did. I don't remember any of it.
He has said things like, he wants to immediately repeal and replace the disaster known as Obamacare. He has said that he wants to get rid of it. He has said in States of the Union, I am calling on Congress to repeal it. He said, can you believe that Mitch McConnell, who has screamed repeal and replace for 7 years, couldn't get it done? So there have literally been hundreds of statements by him, by my colleagues, and I just find it hard to understand that you were not aware of the president's statements.
I am aware that the president opposes the Affordable Care Act. I'm aware that he has criticized the Affordable Care Act. I took Senator Harris's question yesterday to be referring to the specific tweet, maybe the one that you have behind you, about how he wanted to put a justice on the court to replace Obamacare. Mm-hmm. And I'm definitely aware of that tweet now. And as I said to Senator Harris yesterday, it came up in some of my calls with Democratic senators, brought it up. But I honestly can't remember whether I knew about it before I was nominated or mm-hmm. not. I'm not sure.
But did you have then a general understanding that one of the president's campaign promises was to repeal the Affordable Care Act when you were nominated?
As I said before, I'm aware that the president opposes the Affordable Care Act.
Well, I know you're aware now, but were you aware back then?
Well, seems
when you were nominated.
Well, Senator Klobuchar, I think that the Republicans have kind of made that clear. It's just been part of the public discourse.
Okay, but is the answer yes, then, that you were aware of it?
Well, Senator Klobuchar, all these questions, you're suggesting that I have animus or that I cut a deal with the president, and I was very clear yesterday that that isn't what happened.
Senator Amy Klobuchar, Democrat of Minnesota, earlier today with Judge Barrett. Across the aisle, Senator Josh Hawley, Republican of Missouri, defended Judge Barrett from what he said were lines of questioning that, quote, attempt to constantly leverage the worst interpretations of Justice Scalia's philosophy, misrepresentations, and attribute them all to you as if you are the same person. Frankly, I think it's demeaning and insulting, end quote. Here's Senator Hawley earlier today.
Chairman, Judge Barrett, good to see you again. Are you aware of any active litigation challenging the constitutionality of Griswold versus Connecticut?
I am not.
Are you aware of any litigation in recent decades challenging the constitutionality of Griswold versus Connecticut?
I am not.
Are you aware of any legal movement out there to challenge the constitutionality of Griswold versus Connecticut?
I am not, although, Senator Hawley, as I said to Senator Coons, I'm certainly not aware of anybody trying to make the argument that a legislature should prohibit the use of birth control. But as you know, Griswold does lie at the base of the doctrine that very much is challenged in federal court.
Here's my point. I was 7 years old when Judge Robert Bork came before this body. I don't remember any of that. I wasn't watching it as a seven-year-old. But what we saw, I think the legacy of the Bork hearings continue to reverberate. His name has become a verb, the Borking of nominees. I think what we've seen today is an attempted Borking of Judge Amy Barrett. The problem is they don't have anything in your record that they could use to so badly misconstrue, to suggest that you're somehow going to fundamentally change America, that now they have to attribute to you the worst readings and most draconian misinterpretations of Justice Scalia. So we take Scalia's record, we distort that, and then we attribute it to you. So let me just come back to your relationship with Justice Scalia. I was under the impression that you were a different person than Justice Scalia and that you had, your own words, your own mind. Is that fair to say?
That is fair to say.
Is it fair to say that you are an independent woman and an independent jurist and an independent professional and also, by the way, a pretty darn good lawyer, and you'll make up your own mind on the decisions, cases, controversies that come before you to the Supreme Court of the United States? Is that fair to say?
Yes.
I think maybe then we can put to rest this attempt to constantly leverage the worst interpretations of Justice Scalia's philosophy, misrepresentations, and attribute them all to you as if you are the same person. Frankly, I think it is demeaning and insulting. And I'm glad that you pointed that out in response about your independence to the last question.
That was Senator Josh Hawley, Republican of Missouri, earlier today at the Senate Judiciary Committee hearing. Tomorrow's the final day of the hearing with a number of expert witnesses testifying about Judge Barrett. You can watch live starting Thursday morning, 9 a.m. And if you've missed any of the previous day's hearing, you can find them, of course, on our website at cspan.org. This is Washington Today. Across the Atlantic today, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson found himself in the hot seat with questions posed by the leader of the Labour Party. According to the BBC, the Prime Minister told the House of Commons his current policy, quote, can bring down the virus, but he did not rule out going further. Labour leader Sir Keir Starmer again called for a, quote, circuit breaker, a short limited lockdown in England to bring the virus under control. He said such a move was supported by government science advisors. Here's their exchange earlier today in London.
Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, we will do whatever it takes to fight this virus and to defeat it. But since he quotes the sage advice, I might just remind him that on page one it says that all the interventions considered have associated costs in terms of health and well-being, and that policymakers will need to consider analysis of economic impacts and the associated harms alongside this epidemiological assessment. And the advice that I have today, Mr. Speaker, is that if we do the regional approach that commended itself to the House and indeed to the Right Honourable Gentleman on Monday, Mr. Speaker, we can bring down the R and we can bring down the virus. So will he stick to his position of Monday and support that approach?
Yeah. Keir Starmer.
I don't think that approach goes far enough, and neither does Sage. And the Prime Minister... The Prime Minister talks of the costs. Since he rejected Sage's advice on the 21st of September, I remind him, the R rate has gone up, the infection rate has quadrupled, hospital admissions have gone from 275 a day to 628 a day in England. Yesterday, 441 COVID patients were on ventilators, and the number of deaths recorded was tragically the highest since June the 10th. That's the cost of rejecting the advice. Sage has a clear view on why that's happening. What's the Prime Minister's view on why these numbers are all heading in the wrong direction?
Well, Mr. Speaker, I set that out very clearly in the House on Monday, and the difference between this stage of the pandemic and March and April, as the House knows very well, is that the disease is appearing much more strongly in some parts of the country than in others.
British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, Labour Party leader Keir Starmer. On Wednesday, 19,724 new coronavirus cases were recorded in the United Kingdom. Back in Washington, President Trump told business leaders in New York that the U.S. economy would grow a robust 3.5% per year if he were reelected, and that the nation would add 25 million new jobs in a decade. President Trump said in a speech from the White House, streamed online by economic clubs around the country, that the economy was the strongest on record before coronavirus, and he promised vigorous economic growth if he's given another 4 years in office. He also sought to paint a picture of what a victory by Joe Biden and congressional Democrats would mean for the U.S. Here's President Trump.
But I will not rest and I will not relent until all American seniors are safe. That is my sacred obligation. I love our seniors. I love our country. At the same time, we must allow lower risk Americans to resume normal activity. The unscientific lockdowns pushed by left-wing politicians are needlessly destroying millions of lives. They decimate livelihoods and lead to suicide, drug overdose, depression, heart disease, delayed medical treatments, and reduced life expectancy. The cure cannot be worse than the problem itself. And that's what a lot of states run by Democrats have done to their people. And it's turning out very, very bad for them. These lives must be protected as well. The recent months, I have also acted swiftly to rescue the U.S. economy with an unprecedented $2.5 trillion in aid. We delivered over $160 million in relief payments for hardworking Americans through our Paycheck Protection Program that all of you are familiar with. My administration has approved over $650 billion in forgivable loans to more than 5.2 million small businesses. It's been a savior.
You can find the president's entire remarks on our website at cspan.org. In campaign 2020 news, today would have been the 47th birthday of the late George Floyd, whose death earlier this year set off protest marches across the United States. And in a new ad released by Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden's campaign, Bridget Floyd, sister of George Floyd, called for change and stressed the importance of voting to bring about that change. The ad is part of the Biden's campaign's efforts to increase black support in key battleground states, including Minnesota, where George Floyd was killed. It will air nationally on television and radio and in digital outlets as well. In the 30-second ad called Change, Floyd discussed Biden's meeting with her family back in June. Here's that ad.
My name is Bridget Floyd. I am the sister of George Perry Floyd Jr. Joe Biden reached out to the family to actually meet. He was there to listen. He was very sincere. Biden is the change that we need. A lot of people don't really care for voting, don't think that it's important, but it's very important. Your vote does matter. That one vote makes a difference.
I'm Joe Biden, and I approve this message.
Meanwhile, a pro-Trump super PAC, America First Action, recently launched a major new ad buy in Florida, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin as part of a $10 million campaign slamming Joe Biden for supporting bad trade deals and arguing that he would raise taxes. But critics note that some of the people featured in the ad were actors from stock footage from Russia and Belarus. Here's that ad.
40 years in Washington, Joe Biden spent them supporting bad trade deals. He spent them opposing tax cuts for American families. Now, in the middle of a pandemic, Joe Biden supports higher taxes on all of us, on every income group, on middle-class retirement plans, a $4 trillion tax increase that will hurt America's recovery. The Biden plan. Bad trade deals. Higher taxes. America First Action is responsible for the content of this advertising.
And also on election 2020, a report from the New York Post this morning drawing plenty of attention, as well as action from the country's social media giants ahead of Election Day. The story alleges that Joe Biden's son Hunter used his influence to connect a Ukrainian businessman and fellow board member at the gas company Burisma with his father when he was vice president. Supporters of the president quickly seized on the story as proof of Biden family corruption. Biden's campaign responded Wednesday by saying numerous investigations have all concluded that there was, quote, no wrongdoing by the former vice president. The campaign also accused the New York Post of failing to seek comment on critical elements of the story and also pointed out that a review of Joe Biden's official schedules from the time indicated that no meeting ever took place. But it was Facebook and Twitter who stepped into the story today when they took action to restrict users' ability to share the story. Facebook cited the need for further fact-checking. Twitter based its reaction on policies against the distribution of hacked materials. You're listening to Washington Today. Virginia Governor Ralph Northam stopped by CNN this morning to speak more about the alleged kidnapping plot against him. His interview comes on the same day that a federal judge allowed voting registration to continue through midnight tomorrow in the Old Dominion. We'll have more on the voter registration story in a moment, but first, here's more with Governor Northam on the strange circumstances around the alleged abduction plan.
You know, we've been fighting this biological war since February. We've fought it without any supplies. If not for the governors of this country, who we've worked so hard to get PPE, to get our testing, our tracing, if not for governors, we'd be in a terrible position. And so there's a lack of leadership in Washington. And, you know, I think people in this country realize that, John, and you've heard the saying, you know, fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. Americans aren't going to let this happen again and fool me.
So, Governor, I know you say it doesn't faze you or you won't let it faze you or change the way you govern, but it's a remarkable thing when a group is arrested and charged with plotting to kidnap a governor in one state and a similar plot against another governor, or at least discussing a plot against another governor. That would be you. An extraordinary thing. I have not heard anything like that before. So given that, and given that these are charges now being filed by the Justice Department, what have you heard directly from Attorney General William Barr?
I've heard nothing. And, you know, I'll tell you what's disgraceful about this, John. I've been in harm's way. I served in the United States Army for 8 years. I served during Desert Storm. And, you know, in that conflict, we knew that there were folks in the other country in Iraq that disliked us. And they were the ones spewing the hatred and the bigotry. And now it's coming from our own president. And that's what's so disheartening to me as an American, as a governor, as a veteran. And then to have our president refer to people like me as losers and suckers, unacceptable. We're not going to let that happen again in this country.
That was Governor Ralph Northam earlier on CNN. With less than 3 weeks to go now until election 2020, Virginia voters got an extra day this year to register to vote. Sabrina Moreno of the Richmond Times-Dispatch joins us on this story. Sabrina Moreno, explain what happened yesterday that led to today's extension.
Yeah, so, you know, yesterday was a whirlwind, as with everything nowadays. It kind of started with a tweet. And so yesterday morning, the Virginia Department of Elections posted that a Verizon cable was cut near the headquarters of an agency that, you know, provides technical support for various state entities, you know, including the Virginia Department of Health and the Virginia Employment Commission and, of course, the Virginia Department of Elections. So basically the elections website crashed, which meant that on the last day Virginia residents could register to vote, they couldn't online for several hours. And that also impacted early in-person voting, with registrars' offices statewide, you know, citing that they couldn't access the poll books or verify voter eligibility. And even though it was repaired by 3:30, calls had already mounted to extend the registration deadline, which is something that the governor does not have the authority to do and said so in his briefing. And then hours later, a lawsuit was filed.
How is that cable cut?
So there was a roadside utilities project in Chesterfield County. And, you know, they released a statement kind of saying that it was, quote, inadvertently struck. And there's not more information other than that. They're saying it was an accident, and that roadside utilities project is a sewer installation. And that happened in the early morning yesterday, and that project has been in the works since May. And it was right next to the headquarters of this major agency that kind of is the, you know, the technical support for a lot of state agencies. So their websites crashed.
You mentioned the governor's involvement here. How hard is it to change a voter registration deadline in the Old Dominion?
So from what we gathered, it's pretty difficult. And, you know, the governor's legal counsel said yesterday in the briefing that they don't have the authority to just change a voter registration deadline that is in, you know, in the state code. And that they were talking about how that is kind of takes litigation. It takes the courts, and they couldn't file it themselves. They cited legal procedures for that. And so it takes litigation, or it takes the General Assembly. And so this happened back in 2016. There was a computer glitch right before the 2016 election that also occurred, you know, in October. And there was a lawsuit filed again. And back then, Virginians were given a 36-hour extension to register. But back then, it was, you know, a plaintiff has to file the lawsuit. And both times, the Lawyers' Committee for Civil Rights under law was the person who filed it on behalf of, you know, advocacy groups and people who couldn't register to vote.
Is there any way of finding out who tried to register yesterday and couldn't, and to reach out to them, or what's being done to let them know about the extension through tomorrow?
Yeah, so right now we do not have, you know, specific numbers of how many people weren't able to vote, but the lawsuit was filed with the intent to explain how this was out of voters' control and that the website crashing impacted thousands of voters with a disproportionate impact on Black, Indigenous, and Latino people. And so part of the lawsuit also included that registrar's offices, you know, state officials had to issue press releases by 11:30 a.m. this morning, you know, kind of for local registrars to be notified of this order. And so that was also a part of what the federal judge ruled today was, you know, yes, we're extending the deadline in Virginia until 11:59 on Thursday, but you also have to issue press releases. And so that was a way to kind of push this statewide and make sure that, you know, registrars were aware that this extension was granted and that people could be registering to vote, you know, past yesterday's deadline.
Was there anybody arguing against the extension?
So we haven't seen it yet. Of course, we're seeing news kind of change by the hour, but, you know, even Republicans were lauding the decision, and they weren't necessarily, you know, having pushback against the decision, but against Northam's administration. They said that it was a failure of the state for letting this happen. And even the defendant, you know, Virginia Department of Elections commissioner this morning said that, you know, this gives eligible Virginians additional time to register or update their current voter registration record. And in a statement, the Republican Party, you know, kind of made a joke that was like, you know, make sure next time you call Miss Utility. And so, and that's been different than other states. You know, in Florida, there was pushback when last week their registration deadline was pushed. It's been challenged in the courts. But we're not really seeing that right now with Virginia, with the exception that the Republican Party did say that it was Northam's administration's fault. But besides that, have not seen pushback otherwise.
Is there effort to ensure that the voter registration system isn't tied to one cable in the future, or is that something we're expecting in the coming days and weeks?
Yeah, so in the briefing yesterday, someone in Northam's administration was talking about how, you know, this cable was put on, it's a 10 gigabyte circuit. and it was placed in the spring due to COVID, because of the increased workload, because of, you know, a lot of traffic, a lot of people working from home, and so they needed a backup. But the backup to that was not strong enough, and with the inundation of people going to register online, you know, the backup wasn't enough. And so that's what they were kind of explaining, and they said, you know, that they're working on pushing so in the event that something like this were to happen, the backup would be able to sustain it. And so that's kind of where we're at right now. And yeah, and so that's why they were thinking, all right, next time we need a better backup. But as for next steps, we haven't heard much on that.
Sabrina Moreno has been covering the story for the Richmond Times-Dispatch. We appreciate your time on this story.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
If you've missed any part of this episode, you can find it on the free C-SPAN radio app or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Thanks for joining us today on Washington Today. Hope you enjoy the rest of your evening.